una puta solo?
Yes, Greedo. As a matter of fact, I was just going to see your boss. Tell Java that I've got his money.
Son pichare. Maratamti tach makichisa. Java wa ninchikoch babushani haitani wanyaruska. Chaskinyawi uchuzu.
Yeah, but this time I've got the money. I don't have it with me. Tell Java. Even I get bored sometimes. Do you think I had a choice? Over my dead body. Yes, I bet you have. Sorry about the mess.
Five, four, three, two, one, action. Hello, welcome to Stuff We've Seen. This is Jim, and now here he is, the latest addition to the Rudy Giuliani legal defense team, Teal. How's it going, buddy?
Well, good, except I gotta say, I'm not getting paid very well for this gig.
You may not get paid at all.
I don't think I'm getting paid at all. I think I'm doing this pro bono the way Giuliani does everything, right?
What a sport you are. So listen, you know, a year ago to the date of this taping right now, we launched Stuff We Seen.
Wait, a year ago from today's?
Yeah, now we had taped several episodes
Okay. And
got them ready, but the official launch, let the public know that we existed, was a year ago today.
Wow. Okay. So the Thanksgiving week a year ago.
Yep. Well, and remember, Thanksgiving was a different date then. So,
well, yes, but
I think it was right out Thanksgiving, whatever.
Okay.
We launched it so people could enjoy us while they were having their feast or making their feast.
And
I think was the deal.
How many episodes have we done in the last year?
This, I believe, officially is our 44th episode. We did I did that one sort of 70mm story. I don't think that counts as an official episode.
Yeah, so. I don't think that. Yeah. Well, it's a 0.5 maybe.
Yeah. So we didn't quite get an episode a week done. But, you know, we did a lot more than I think we thought we were going to be able to record. I thought I would get you maybe for one episode and then you'd disappear and that never done again. And I was like, well, that was fun. And
then, yeah, that was fun. We did that once.
Yeah. And I'll be like, I'm glad I spent the money to host on Podbean. But hey.
But we've actually made use of it.
Yeah, and we did, there's a couple of things. I mean, again, I would like to say that this show has exceeded my wildest dreams. But, my wildest dreams would someone heard this and said, you guys should be on the radio for a show a day and we'll pay you. So that didn't happen. But it did exceed my expectations in a lot of ways because we didn't know anybody would listen to the show. And a lot of people have. And we've had several episodes that have done quite well.
Yeah.
And we started a website and we got it on Instagram and all these things.
And we've had guests.
And we've had guests. That was another thing that I think we thought, boy, what if we could get a guest on the show?
Yeah.
Hey, you know what? And this may be an uncomfortable moment, but
oh, I know exactly where you're going. But
well, you just mentioned guests, so I thought, I want to just tell a story for a listener out there. Is a few episodes ago, we did we featured this odd movie on Amazon called Buzzard, right?
Yes.
And I think it was you and your big mouth. You said that
maybe the director should, yeah.
Yeah, maybe the director, Joel Petroikis, would like to come on, right? So guess what? Word got out to Joel Petroikis. He checked out our episode, and then he sent us an email and said, okay, guys, I'm in.
Okay, so
And then I said, well, I don't. I said, like, let me get my partner because he's the one who, you know, invited you on the show and he'll get back to you. Well, I think it's been a month now since we received that email from Joel Petroikis, and you have not gotten back
to
him.
So I would like to apologize to Joel. I'll try to get to you this week.
try to get to him this week, which means maybe in a few months, Joel, and then I'll just take over and I'll send you the apology. Then maybe you'll still want to come on the show.
We'll go on an apology tour, and perhaps you'll still be up for coming on our show. We'll see.
Well, I'd like to talk to him because I saw another one of his films.
You saw Alchemist Cookbook, right?
Yes, and I was very fascinated by it.
I will watch that, and Relaxer is his most recent film, correct?
Yes, I thought, and of course, you know, now he'll probably take access away, but I think he was trying to give us access to that movie so we could watch that and we could talk to him about that, but you know.
We'll see.
So my apologies to Joel out there, you know, big fan, I know,
yes.
Is of us. maybe not so much anymore, but we do want him on the show, and anybody else that wants to come on the
and
show.
Anyone else who wants to go. Yeah, we're still holding out for Terrence Malick.
Oh, man. Okay. So we're talking about the Holy Grail. Wouldn't that be amazing that nobody can get this guy, but then suddenly that would be like a very Malick thing to do, right? He wouldn't do any interviews, but he'd come on our show. And boy, would I would clear the decks and it would be a 5-part episode because I have a lot to ask this guy.
Yeah. I have a bone to pick with him over his most recent films.
Well, I haven't seen the new one, Hidden Life, which is coming out in December.
I haven't seen that either, but... The last
it's pretty good.
Look, it's just those last three just blend together for me.
Well, here's the weird thing, right? Why does it work with Tree of Life and then it didn't work for the others? And I can't tell you, but my concern was that after seeing as much as I could handle of those other three films, like was it Knight of Cups, Song to Song. And what was the, and then Into the Mystic, I don't know, what was it called? It was Into the Wonder, right?
To the Wonder.
Or To the Wonder.
Yeah.
I got through all of Knight of Cups.
Okay.
I've got through about half of Song to Song, and then I got through like maybe a half hour of To the Wonder. And I revisited Tree of Life. The new, like, reimagining of it that was on Criterion.
Oh, right. Yes, there's the longer version, right?
And it's like a 3-hour version. Yeah. I got through only the first hour, and the reason I had to stop was because I just didn't have the time with my wife to watch it because it's a must-see. It's like a completely different movie. Restructured it. It's like you're watching some scenes that are familiar. Oh, yeah, I remember seeing those about 10 years ago, and yet it's all different. And it is so magnificent.
Wow.
So and why that works, I don't know, while the others didn't.
Yeah, is it because, well, I don't know, there's all sorts of reasons potentially, but it's period, which I think changes it somehow.
Maybe, but it's for what I saw so far the first hour, it is so fantastic. You know, director's cuts are funny things. I feel that for the large part of them, they shouldn't even exist. They're not so great.
Yeah, I tend to agree. They're sometimes just feel like expanded editions, and they end up feeling kind of loose and just not as focused as the original.
And I wasn't planning on talking about this to start the show, but maybe this is a good place to start.
Yeah.
So I want to talk about director's cuts and a couple of things.
Oh, but before we go on, I have one question, though. Where did you see this this cut of Tree of Life?
It's on Criterion. Not on the channel, but the actual, I bought it.
Oh, okay. Okay.
You can get a deluxe edition.
Okay. So you can't stream it, but somewhere out there is you need the Blu-ray. Okay. I got it.
Yeah. I would highly recommend this as a pickup. Christmas is coming.
High on my list.
The goose is getting fat. please put a Criterion Blu-ray of Tree of Life.
Life in the sack.
In the sack. I'm glad we can amuse each other. So this isn't necessarily a director's cut. The worst offender of all time, forever, and he will be up there in the annals of please no more director's cuts from you ever, sir, is George Lucas. All right.
Oh, we're going to talk about this now?
We're going to talk about this for just a brief second, because I know there's probably every show on earth has talked about how he's, you know, wrecked the Star Wars trilogy with his fixes, but...
Right, and he's wrecked it over and over and over again.
Yeah, and I get where he was coming from, right? His desires is whatever he said, this is the way I wanted them, blah, 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 blah. And I have no problem with making these special editions, what have you, as long as there exists the original in their flaws and all format. And yet they refuse to put those out because, I mean, I have children, right?
Yeah.
And they haven't seen the films the way they should be. And I thought, well, maybe once Disney completely takes over and absorbs the Fox studios.
Maybe they'll see some advantage in releasing classic editions or something.
Yeah, call them the Disney Mouse from the Vault classic, right? Star Wars editions. And then, lo and behold, with their new streaming service, which I don't have because my sons are just not that interested in Disney movies anymore, right? That we need to, even for $6 a month, we don't need to sign up for that. They being Disney, well, they put out the trilogy on their streaming service.
Yep.
And anybody that thought maybe they would put out the originals, well, they were sorely mistaken, because they went ahead and that classic Han Solo Greedo battle and who shot first, which we all know was Han Solo, and it's been muddied many times since 1997. First, it was a very awkward edit to make it look like Greedo shot first. And then they tried to... add some extra frames or something to make it a little bit clearer, but it was still embarrassing.
It was still terrible, yeah.
But now they've gone ahead and they've altered it even more, where Greedo kind of shouts out a battle cry of McClunky. And I thought it was almost a joke when I first saw it, that somebody put this in because that's how embarrassing it is. And yet it's there it is. It's a real thing. And what it said to me is—
Have you seen the clips? I haven't seen a clip.
Oh my God, I saw the clips, yes. And you have to see it, because what it tells me is there's actually an executive, right? Somebody has to green light this. They say kids need more explanation. And you know what? And kids don't need an explanation.
Because, no, they don't.
Because you know what? If you're going to go there, you had a whole series. And I watched it because I had kids of a certain age that really were into this for a while.
Right.
There was that cartoon, the Star Wars Rebels.
Oh, yeah. I watched some of that. Yeah.
Yeah. And so almost in every episode, the people you're rooting for, the rebels, they're killing off poor Imperial stormtroopers left and right.
Yeah.
With no conscience. And so what I'm left with, that in the Star Wars universe, they view life and death much differently than they do on this planet.
Yes, I think that's true.
And I think that's one thing that, I think kids get that. They look and say, yeah, you know, way people get shot and killed, it's just, it's a different value system over there in the galaxy far, far away.
It is. Yeah, life is a little more expendable.
And I think that I always accepted, because I saw the movie when it first came out when I was 7, that, Han Solo just shot first because he was going to be killed by this guy.
Right.
He knew what the score was. He knew that the guy was coming in to pay the debt. And so there was no need for some moral clarity.
No, and especially since, I see this scene kind of as like a High Noon kind of scene, right? Where both characters have their hand on their gun.
Exactly.
And somebody's going to draw first.
Yeah, because it's a space western.
Because it's a space western, exactly. And so Han shooting first means he just got the jump on the other guy.
Yeah, and
shooting second...
I don't know if they filmed this at the same time, but because in the special edition they put in that ridiculous Jabba the Hutt scene, and it wasn't a scene that was working, which is why it was cut out. But it felt to me that in its place was the Greedo scene, because almost the exact same information is exchanged.
You're right. Yes.
Yeah. So it actually really is awkward when you watch it. And that's just like one little slice of the problems I have with those 97 movies.
Yeah.
And the biggest is that those effects don't hold up now. The old effects, they hold up because they were cemented in the time and place of what was the technology in 1977.
Yes.
But then you put a layer on top of them of these 1997 effects that just don't hold up.
They don't hold up
came
now.
Afterwards.
Yeah. What did they redo the effects again to make it?
I don't think they have. No. Okay. And then you know what? This is another crazy thing, right? And I was almost 13 when Jedi came out.
Yeah.
And I was a kid who, I mean, I wasn't in love with the Ewoks, but I never had a problem with them.
Right.
I'm just being honest.
Yeah, I didn't
and
either.
And I liked the frickin' Ewok song. And
oh, I love the Ewok song.
When I went to the theater to see these new additions, I saw all three of them when they came out.
Me
you know,
too.
They came out like a few weeks ahead of each other, like it was like Star Wars, and then they did The Empire again.
Yeah.
And I don't think they did too bad a job with the revisions there. But then
there wasn't as much to do the movie.
Exactly. But then when they went in and they started messing with Return of Jedi, they did two things. There was this like little cabaret singing on Jabba's palace.
Yes. Yep.
And they went and did this ridiculous overdone CGI and they changed the song and everything.
Yes.
And I was like, what the hell, man?
Yeah. Put in all these extra shots. It was weird.
And then the ending, my jaw dropped when they went in and they didn't have the Ewok song. I'm like, you mother effers, what the hell is this? It was abhorrent to me. And then, of course, sticking in like, older Anakin later, they did this where they, instead of the old man.
Right, yes, yes. They put in
they
Hayden
stuck
Christensen.
In yeah. Christensen. These are just things where too much frickin' tinkering.
Yeah, and apparently that shot of Hayden Christensen as the Force Ghost at the end was not, they didn't even shoot that?
No, that was just added in digitally later.
No. What I mean is they didn't even shoot him doing that. They just used like a screen test shot of him.
Well, that's what I'm saying is there was literally just something that there was like footage that they found a way to like convert it in. And it's just.
Yeah. So he does. He looks like he's just standing there. He's not acting in the scene because it was just a screen test shot. Now, I will mention this. I have seen these. I don't have access to them, but there are out in the world something called the despecialized editions.
Yes, yes. And you know what? You can find some of that stuff on YouTube and maybe it gets taken. But like it's not the same as having, you know, a remastered pristine copy.
Yeah.
Of.
Apparently there is a version of episode 4 called the Silver Screen Edition. which is basically they went back to 35 millimeter elements and built this. That's supposed to be, I haven't seen it, but I did a few years ago, went into reading about this. It's kind of like, Smile, the Beach Boys Smile album. which didn't get released. And so people made their own versions of it for years and years. And
of course, this is on our podcast called Stuff We've Heard.
Right. Yes.
Look for it soon. Where we discuss and dissect the music industry.
Oh, man.
All right. So anyways, all right. Enough of Star Wars. Right?
Enough of Star Wars. Yeah.
Everybody's dissatisfied, but yet there's some executive out there that actually is still on board with the program. And that's what makes me really concerned about the Star Wars franchise moving forward.
We'll
probably talk about it with the new film coming out.
They fired those Game of Thrones guys.
Yeah, I don't know if they fired them or did the Game of Thrones guys fire themselves. I think you know what it is that I think that people like that, they were very in control of the Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
And HBO trusted them because they loved the the audience that they were getting. And then you go over to you spin the wheel of death over to Disney,
right.
And you realize that whoa, this is a committee. And the scariest part of this whole Star Wars franchise, I hear, is the name Kevin Feige or whatever his name is.
Feige. Yeah.
He's getting involved. And that just means lots of money and lots of horror for the franchise.
Yeah.
And I just realized, okay, you know what? I have my Star Wars. I was lucky. I got when Star Wars was just a franchise with three movies. That's what it was, right? And I had that. And I will enjoy it and everything else afterwards. It's just been meh.
Yeah, it's not doing it for me anymore. But I will see the new Star Wars movie.
Of course, I'll see it. But I'm already, maybe I'll like it because after The Last Jedi, I my expectations are pretty low.
Yeah, my expectations are pretty. I don't even know who directed this new one.
Well, you know, it's back to the guy who did The Force Awakens, J.J. Abrams.
Wait, he's doing this one?
Yeah.
Oh man.
Yeah, he is.
Oh man.
You know what my favorite thing is? I see this on the internet. I see it on like Twitter a lot. There are these like Last Jedi apologists who are trying to make it their mission to have everybody and their brother accept that the Last Jedi is the best of all of them. And it's usually a millennial that wants to say this. And it's like, stop that. Stop that. Okay, but so here's the this is the setup. The Star Wars thing was the setup for the director's cut that I want to just mention.
Yes.
It's good old Ari Aster's Midsommar.
Oh, yeah.
The director's cut. Well, my wife, huge Midsommar fan, saw it twice in the theater, has been just salivating over this director's cut. So she through her work, got a new iPhone.
Okay.
The new iPhone.
Oh, yeah.
11, whatever. And because of that, she actually got a free year of Apple Plus.
Oh.
Yeah, there's nothing good on there. But
right, yeah, but that's interesting.
but there's a lot of, but the app is a lot of 4K content that you can buy or rent.
Right, okay.
So she purchased Midsommar because she found out that through the extras on there, they had the director's cut.
Oh.
So we're all set to watch this thing because she's all excited.
Yeah.
And lo and behold, the Apple Plus app on Roku doesn't offer the extras. Only on your computer, your Apple computer. Man. Or if you had Apple TV, I guess.
Right.
They F you on the app.
Oh, man.
And this is the thing is, Apple, right? They used to make the smartest moves.
Right. They don't anymore.
This is the dumbest move is that you have heavy competition from streamers. You're trying to launch a service and you're getting somebody like the whole purpose. If someone's excited about using your service because they want to rent or she actually had to buy.
Right.
She made like $14 purchase of this Midsommar so she could get it. Make it cross-platform to have the extras. Don't – come on.
Criterion gives you all the extras.
Exactly.
It wouldn't be hard to do. And I can't imagine there's some digital rights issue around that. That would just be absurd.
They'd just be in scums. So now we've got this movie and I'm not going to watch it on a laptop, right?
Right.
So then we're like, well, we have like this projector set up downstairs in our basement.
Oh, right. You could
hook
the laptop.
Maybe we can plug it in.
Yeah.
Yeah. But her laptop, of course, doesn't have today. It's so thin. It doesn't have today's HDMI. So then she actually goes to Amazon and she gets a converter, right? Sent. So that we can watch it Saturday night. Converter comes by Saturday night. We get it. We get downstairs. And you know what? Our projector and the receiver down there, it's can't handle all of this newfangled stuff.
Right.
And all we were getting were these like flashes and weird things. And it's just, you know, she got the intro screen up on the screen. But as soon as she hit play, it was like green flashes. And it was like, oh no. And it sounded great out of our speakers. We could hear it, but we couldn't see it.
Well, you could have had that on Stuff We've Heard.
That's right. It's a different show.
I just listen to director's cuts.
So we went upstairs and I'm like, well, wait a minute. So she was all defeated and I was like, oh, right. I guess you can watch it at the gym on your small screen phone or whatever. But I was like, well, wait a minute. What about our TV upstairs? You know, that has HDMI. Yeah. Look, maybe we can plug it up. So we get it to work after all this effort. Right? And now, of course, it's way too late to watch a three-hour movie. So we can only watch the first 2 hours of it. So we watch the first 2 hours of the director's cut. And we haven't watched the last 50 minutes, but I think I've seen a good portion of the new footage. And I don't want, you know, this is what I would say. As I've always said with director's cuts, the original is really the best.
Right.
There's a little bit of extra information that you get that I think is helpful. When we talked about Midsommar, there were some things that kind of you didn't felt worked, and maybe this extra explanation in the film might help you.
Right. Oh, yeah. There was that one scene that we were talking about where they get in a fight.
Yeah. And so, but while the information I think is interesting, the tone of the film changes with the extra scenes.
Interesting.
And so that's the problem, is that if you were a first-time viewer, I think the experience of the movie, it's more intense. And then the comedy is more like breaks up some the tension, rather than some of the scenes are a little bit too comic. And I just, if you were first time off the bat, I would recommend seeing the original. And if you really liked it, then maybe you'd want to another time see the director's cut. And if you have seen it and you want, like me, we watched it in a much different way than we watched it the first time, because it wasn't as intense once you know all the stuff that's going to happen.
Right, right. Yes, of course.
You know, so, and I was looking, so a couple of things, and again, it's not spoilers, but I now, as you know, when we talked about the film, I had a theory.
Uh-huh. Yes, you had a theory.
Pele was involved in the murder or suicide of her
Her family, that he was somehow chosen her ahead of time. Yeah,
exactly. But I also felt that, well, I only saw, you know, I was absorbing a lot of stuff and I could very well have gotten that wrong. And, you know, I mean, anything in a movie, I still think that everything is always up for interpretation. But I am more on the side of he was not involved.
Okay, okay.
Seeing it a second time, I really spent time watching how the opening minutes unfolded.
And thinking the about that, yeah.
And the timing and how it was sort of intercut with her conversing with her boyfriend while he was at a cafe with the guys talking. So I'm pretty feel comfortable that it just happened to be an incident that sets her up for the journey that she's going to be in. And I think that's what, you know, anybody that argued with me on Reddit, but again, that's what it is. It's a discussion.
You're admitting that maybe your interpretation was not all it was cracked up to be on first view.
Yeah. So I'm going to go see the rest of it. Maybe we'll watch it this week at some point. And then if you get the chance to watch the director's cut, it'd be interesting for us to get back together and just kind of discuss some of those details. But I'm just saying is that, again, these director's cuts, they're interesting, but I hate the thought of them replacing the experience of the original film.
Right. Yeah. Well, and I think, I don't know, a lot of them seem to still coexist and haven't replaced the original films.
Right. You know, like that's the whole thing is like Francis Ford Coppola, he keeps tinkering away with Apocalypse Now.
Right.
And he does have this new cut, which is less than the Redux version. I'm curious to watch that version, but as long as it's not, say, this is the definitive version, you
right?
know?
You mean like all five definitive versions of Blade Runner?
Right, the final cut and all that. And I think I've seen most of the cuts.
Yeah.
And I don't think I've watched from beginning to end the final cut, but I've seen parts that were added into it and changed.
Okay.
And, you know, ultimately, a lot of times when they put these things in, they do something like with the, like we said with the Star Wars. They actually tinker with something else.
Right.
That, and this is the problem with doing that. Once this thing is out into the world, that becomes not just your movie anymore that you made, but it's an audience's movie. And you don't know what moment in a movie is a particular audience member's favorite part.
Yeah.
And when you take that away, and this is what our show is so much about, is about the experience. And like, you know, when I saw Return of the Jedi opening day in 1983, it's not saying that the ending with the Ewok singing was my favorite part.
No, but it's part of the experience.
Yeah, and it was like the ending of that trilogy that we never knew whether we were going to get any more of.
Right.
And it was so unnecessary. And again, I understand he was in uncharted territory making these prequels, because we really hadn't had that. We hadn't had a film series that then went back and was going to tell the first three chapters.
No, yeah, we hadn't. Yeah.
So we felt like for some reason we have to be introduced to all these other worlds. Like we wouldn't imagine that there was going to be other worlds other than Hoth and Tatooine.
Right.
But it was sloppy. And, you know, it was the first time I think that I questioned the genius of George Lucas, who was like a childhood idol of mine.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah.
You know, Ari Aster is not a childhood idol of mine.
But, no, me neither. And I don't. I'm curious to see this version of Midsommar, but I suspect I won't like it as much.
It doesn't ruin it. And again, I don't want to spoil things. I will say that when we talked about this argument scene,
yes,
and I think it's the argument scene and a scene that happens that leads up to that argument,
right?
Are kind of the like a good chunk, maybe 10 or so minutes of the new footage.
Oh, okay.
And so what happens is that if they had included the scene that happened before the argument,
right,
they wouldn't have had a good place to cut to.
Oh, okay.
If they cut out the argument. And I think that the reason why they cut out the argument, not because it wasn't important, it wasn't in terms of their breaking sort of up in their relationship.
Yeah, and their motivation for what comes after.
Is the argument wasn't written or directed well.
Okay, so it just didn't really work.
I think you have to see it, but I didn't buy, and it wasn't, I don't think it was the actor's fault. It's the dialogue that they gave Christian
okay.
to say. It was not, it was flimsy, I thought.
Okay.
And I bet you that that's what the editors did too. And if something had to go.
That can go, yeah.
And that happens a lot of times. You see these scenes that get put back in for these director's cuts. And while they're interesting and they offer some piece of information, which is probably why they were shot in the first place.
Right.
They weren't executed as well. And when you're editing, you're like, you know, this is just not the best acted. It's not the best shot. It didn't feel, right. It was like the heart
really,
wasn't in it.
That really messes up the pacing.
Yes.
If the audience has to go through a scene like that, that isn't quite as engaging.
Yeah, I always liked it in the sort of the golden age of DVD when you first started getting all these extra features.
Yes.
You'd get all of these missing scenes, but almost every single time, while I found a lot of these scenes interesting, I said, yeah, I know why it was cut out.
Yeah, exactly.
But I would tell you there is, while it doesn't make the film any better, like I said, there is one thing that happens before this fight that is intriguing, and it explains something in the ending that didn't make as much sense. So I think, again, worthwhile.
You're not going to tell me?
Do you want me to?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, listen, shut your ears if you haven't seen Midsommar or if you haven't seen the director's cut. But, you know, most of this film takes place in the day.
Yes.
And eventually you start to see those brief areas of night.
Yes. There's a few dark scenes. Yeah. But also yes. There's very little nighttime in the environment they're in.
Right. Well, there's a nighttime ritual.
Yes.
That gets cut out of the movie.
Oh.
And there's a scene that also got cut out where Christiane is invited in to help sew some costume.
Oh, interesting.
And this costume has like all these like metal things on it. It's almost like a weird like kind of a Christmas tree decoration. And it turns out there's this ceremony where they throw this tree into the lake at night. And it's sort of like an offering of nature. Then they say, well, that offering's not enough, that their okay. gods or whatever want
right.
more. Then this little boy steps forward and he's wearing this outfit that they were making.
Oh, okay.
And Florence Pugh's there and Christiane's there. Or maybe he's not and she runs into him in the woods afterwards, but she's there and they are bringing him and they're going to offer him to the lake.
Okay.
And they like pick him up and they give this huge big stone and they latch everything to him.
Okay.
And they're going to swing him in there and he's going to be sacrificed. And she screams because she had just seen this other stuff
right,
that had happened,
right?
And then they stop and they say, well, your heroism was enough and you've been saved. And it's not clear whether or not
interesting.
They would ever really sacrifice. But so what happens is when she's running into the woods with Christiane and she wants out, she's like really upset. She's like, let's get out of here now.
Right.
And she's like cognizant enough that this is getting too crazy. And that these people, and she really doesn't know what's real and what's not. So at the end, when all the crap goes down and there's the
right.
sacrificial moment and all the different people have been sacrificed, I don't remember because I haven't seen it yet. I read about it afterwards.
Right.
But one of the two, you remember the British travelers that take
yes,
off
and
one's been mysteriously driven to the train station
exactly.
and the other one, and you hear her scream. I don't know whether it's her or him, but one of them, when they're wheeled in, is wearing that suit. So clearly one of them was actually sacrificed. So the kid may have been the one that was going to be sacrificed.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
So that is interesting. And it does explain what happened to different people a little bit.
Right. But it's not totally necessary.
No, and then the fight, like I said, it gets ridiculous over something that, again, you'll see it, and okay. It's just, it's not the strongest fight that, it just, it reinforces that they're breaking apart.
Right, right.
You know, and that Christian's a real jackass.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's, you know, that's part of the thing, I think, with horror films in general, but it's, you are often rooting for the characters to be killed.
Yeah, and you know what, the points that I've read is that when you don't have that scene, it makes what happens at the ending a little bit more shocking, and you're a little bit more like, well, is she just overcome with, like, you know, with the cult or other things, and that Christian really deserve it? And if anything, this maybe adds to him deserving a bit more. So it almost like gives the audience a way to root for her. And so that's why when it's not there, it's almost better, in my opinion.
Right, right. Because it's more ambiguous and it's a more complicated feeling for the audience.
Yeah. And then there's a little scene. See, what was so great at the beginning when he doesn't invite her to Sweden and she finds out about it, and then, you know, you cut to, like, it's like a very well-edited cut to the people that he's, you know, hanging out with, and he's like, listen, I invited her, but she's not coming, and it's kind of like a funny moment. But in the new cut, you actually get some explanation where it goes into much more detail where she's, you know, upset that he didn't invite her, and she's like, oh, well, you ruined the surprise. I was going to invite you. So, like, it's not a bad scene, but what happens is the payoff from the great editing, it's not as good.
Okay.
Because we already have an indication that she's probably going to come now.
So it's interesting to be able to compare cuts like this and really see what an editor does.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's great to watch this because I was really enjoying watching it again. I mean, it's just so superbly crafted. But this is the thing about horror movies. Right. When you don't know anything about the film and you go in cold and you see in the screen all that intensity, I don't feel most horror films hold up to that sustained intensity when you watch it a second time.
No, they don't. It's that visceral experience the first time. You know, I think there are some that hold up the second time. Like Alien still gets to me.
Yeah, and I think sometimes, you know, the longer it is between viewings helps. That Insidious movie we watched with my son, I hadn't seen it, you know, since it first came out on video or whatever.
Right.
And so I couldn't remember everything, and so some of it was pretty intense.
I watched a low-budget horror film recently.
Oh, yeah? What was that? I want to know what, you know, you've seen a movie.
I don't know.
Is already, you know, shock, but...
I can't recommend this movie. It's called Crawl.
Wait, what is it called?
Crawl.
Crawl or Crawl?
Crawl. C-R-A-W-L.
Oh, Crawl. Okay.
And it's about alligators in a basement.
Oh, wait a minute. That came out this summer, right?
Yeah.
Quentin Tarantino loved that movie.
He did. Yep.
Oh, it's not good? Didn't Sam Raimi produce that?
Yeah. I mean, the thing is, it's almost good.
It's almost good. Well, isn't that like most horror movies? Almost good.
It's almost good. And, you know, the alligators are, some of the alligator stuff is really good. The action parts of the movie are pretty good. The dialogue is pretty ridiculous and not performed all that well.
You mean a movie about alligators isn't?
Yeah, they tried to do some character development, which I feel like should have just been cut. like, I would rather just watch the action and suspense parts. You know, what was that movie that John Krasinski directed, The Quiet Place?
Yeah.
Well, that was nice because, you know, hardly had any dialogue. But because of that, it had to rely on cinematic tension and all these other techniques, and Crawl sort of, I just didn't love it. And if you're into horror movies, I think Will Ennial will probably like it.
Look at that. Sort of like a life serial. Oh, give it to Will Ennial.
Give it to Will Ennial.
Don't watch anything.
I just got bored with it, I think is really what it comes down to. I was not sucked into the tension of it. I wasn't scared. I just wasn't viscerally involved with it.
Well, maybe when it comes on cable, I'll watch it.
Yeah.
I saw a couple comedies.
Oh, I saw a comedy.
Which one did you see?
I saw Blinded by the Light.
Well, that's that one that's kind of crafted around Bruce Springsteen music, right?
Yeah, it's pretty cool. It's and I think it's a true story. I think it's like semi-autobiographical. and it's about this Pakistani kid growing up sort of in a small town or a suburban town in England.
Wait, does he get in a bike accident and then he can suddenly sing Bruce Springsteen songs and no one knows who it is?
No.
Oh, wait a minute. That was yesterday.
No, it doesn't. It has no magical realist elements.
Good, because that's like a thing that I don't usually like.
So. It's a straight up family comedy, and it's about this kid who sort of finds, I don't know, somebody he just really connects with Springsteen's music. And so it's really just a coming of age story of, you know, going on your first date kind of thing. The father is really funny. He keeps accusing Bruce Springsteen. He keeps saying, who is this Jewish American you're listening to all the time? And then at the end, he finally says, I listen to this Bruce Springsteen. He sings about working hard and respecting your elders. Are you sure he's not Pakistani?
Well, I love those coming of age movies, so and maybe so I'm in for that.
Yeah, it's a really cute, you know, and I think it's sort of underrepresented. I don't, you know, there's not a lot of movies about Pakistani kids coming of age in England in the 80s, but it really plays all these different cultural aspects in a really interesting way, and sort of the way his family works, his sisters live with them, and then, you know, sort of this American freedom ideal. And so anyhow, he loves Bruce Springsteen. It's a great, I really enjoyed it. It reminded me a little bit of Sing Street. And yeah, it's a great coming of age family comedy. I think all ages can enjoy it. Yeah.
And that's like a rental right now, right? It's not available it's not like on Amazon or anything.
No, I rented it.
Right. And there's like, there's two films that are comedies. One I rented on Redbox, and then the other is available on Hulu.
Okay.
Well, so the Redbox one is Good Boys, which is that, you know, outrageous, super baddish comedy about sixth graders. And it was rated R, and we watched it with our sixth grader, and he found it hilarious. Even though the kids he felt, and we felt too, acted more like fourth graders, which is, you know, okay. I know that sounds strange, but like that I think sometimes adults kind of forget exactly what sixth grade is, because it was like the kids acted in a way that like fourth graders might act, but maybe not sixth graders. But
so wait, hilarious. It's like a sixth grade gross out comedy?
Yeah, it was hilarious.
Okay.
Yeah. It was hilarious.
I kind of got to see it.
And then, I think you'll get a kick out of it. But then we also
even though I don't like comedies.
I know you don't like comedies, but you'll still chuckle and then say, because you got to get past the fact that there's all of these, you know, like it's those mission things. They got to get from A to B in a certain thing, and then shenanigans ensue. And then I saw the kind of critically adored but underappreciated by audiences, Olivia Wilde's Booksmart.
Oh, yes.
And
I've been wanting to see that.
Well, it's definitely worth seeing, I would say. And I think that Olivia Wilde showed some director chops in the film. So to me, it started off a little bit like a wokester comedy.
Okay.
And then,
Are there other wokester comedies?
I don't know. Maybe this is the first.
Are you creating, subgenre or does it already
exist? Here's what I mean. It tries really hard to kind of tick all the boxes. Hey, you know, we're going to make sure that it's not just a one character ethnicity. Let's make sure that, you know, this is the most multicultural cast of high schoolers we've ever seen.
Okay.
And let's make sure that, the different sexualities are represented. And, it's definitely, it feels like it's really a little bit heavy handed.
Right. Okay.
However, once that kind of kicks in and it's like established, then it's offering me some funny stuff that I haven't seen before. And then the two lead actresses are really, really funny. And I really like their journey. And the first 50 minutes of this movie really turned out to be so hilarious, so outrageous. And I think a star-making comedy performance from Carrie Fisher's daughter, Billy Lord.
Oh, okay. And she's sort of a supporting character, not one of the main
supporting characters. I actually had to look up because I'm like, man, this is kind of a hilarious character that's been created. And it turns out that she was so funny that they kept deciding we got to add her into more scenes.
Really?
But of course, you can't just add someone in more scenes. So they figured out a way. And this character keeps showing up, but it's as much of a surprise to the two main characters as it would be to the audience of like, how the hell are you getting here? And it becomes like a running joke, but it works. It's very funny. So we watched it in two parts because we just couldn't finish it all because our son was watching this too and he was enjoying it. And so we waited another couple of days, whatever, to watch it, finish it. But the second half really, it gets very much into situation comedy and there's things that I just don't feel worked as well and it just wasn't as strong. So as a whole, I enjoyed it. A lot to recommend. It's certainly some laughs. But I would be weary of any film reviewer, and there's some out there, who put this on their top 10 and say, this is like, you know, anything more than it really is.
Okay.
It's kind of like with Eighth Grade last year. It's like, calm down, people. It is not the second coming of age movies.
Right. Okay.
It was a good movie with lots of flaws, and people need to be schooled if they don't recognize the flaws in Eighth Grade. But it's good. But come on, calm down, people. There's a lot of problems with Booksmart that you have to overcome. It really suffers in the third act. It really, really stretches, and you can't excuse that.
Yeah, you can't really. Okay, so
but I recommend it.
I'm less excited to see it now.
Well, but you know, I mean, again, I don't.
Although
know
now
what
I know what I'm getting into, I might be a little more forgiving.
Well, let's put it this way. I don't know. See, your daughter is a little older than my son. I don't know what you guys let her watch. And she might enjoy some of the aspects because I think it gets into some female themes that you are.
Okay.
Maybe this is why critics like about it is that, hey, we have a comedy that at its heart is honest about female relationships and the things they're going through.
Okay.
As they graduate high school and stuff. And I think there was stuff, that's why, you know, why we don't mind our son watching it, because he was able to relate to some of the stuff that's going on there, and he thought it was funny.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, my only limitation on content, really, with my older daughter, it's fine with me if she sees an R-rated movie. The thing I limit on content is anything that will disturb her to the point that I'll have to deal with it for a few days afterwards.
Well, I don't know what that is. I mean, in comedy, I mean, you know.
In comedy. It would have to be, you know, some like really dark, twisted horror drama.
But no, there's nothing. I just, you know, again, I don't know what kind of comedies she's seen because that can be shocking in itself if you haven't really seen any body comedies. And this thing definitely isn't afraid to go there. And I actually do. I really think that Olivia Wilde, you know, not everybody is a director. You know, you see it in every comedy. I think that she thought about how is this movie going to be shot and ways that I can use the camera to be funny. And, you know, that's either you have that or you don't. And so I think she has it. And I'm looking forward to what she comes up with next.
Okay. Well, that's very cool. It's always nice to see people branching out from there.
But if I was going to be honest, I thought Good Boys was funnier. I don't think you compare them, but it was like there were similar themes and it was a good double bill. But I just personally thought that Good Boys knew that it was going to be a little bit ridiculous in its plot points. Booksmart tried to think that they were beyond that and then they still fell into the traps.
Okay. So they became sort of sitcom-y without being self-aware about it.
Yeah, but Booksmart has the better side characters.
Okay.
Like I guess Good Boys have their main characters, but the side characters they encounter aren't that good. Booksmart has both great leads and the side characters. The teenagers, they're all pretty hilarious. I don't know. And then some of the characters are in both movies, the actors.
That's an interesting coincidence.
Yeah, and after just seeing it, you're like, oh, I just saw that actor or actress in the last movie. So. Anyway, so I saw that, and then in the theater, I saw Ford versus Ferrari, James Mangold film, and I don't want to get into too many details of it, but I will say that it is a Hollywood movie all the way. It certainly ticks all of the biopic boxes, but it is done with a lot of style, finesse, and fun, and two great leading performances that are very entertaining from the other half of the Affleck there, the Matt Damon.
Matt Damon.
Yeah, the Matt Damon and Christian Bale.
And the Dick Cheney, yeah.
Yeah, the Dick Cheney. Oh, I know. So that guy's a chameleon because he here he looks like Christian Bale. There, he looked like somebody completely different.
He looks different in Ford versus Ferrari, though. I mean, he looks like Christian Bale, but
he looks actually a lot like the real guy. Yes. That's what the thing is. I know that story. I've seen the documentary that it's based on, and my son is a huge Formula One enthusiast. So watching this film, the first thing is somebody who actually understands car racing a little bit now.
Right.
I look and say, is it authentic? And yes, it is. Did they get the details of the race right? Yes, they did. Did they get the major points along the way that would really make it dramatic and actually really happened?
Right.
Yes, they did. So I really liked it. It might be a good film to see at Thanksgiving. You know?
Yeah, so it's a good Hollywood entertainment. What's it rated? PG-13 probably?
PG-13, yeah. 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 Oh, yeah. I mean, I don't know if your daughters are going to be interested in that film, but you'd like it.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I probably won't go to see it in the theater.
And now here's the biggie.
Yeah.
That I want to just set the stage for you. I saw The Irishman.
Yes. And
I saw it in the theater.
I don't want to talk about it because I know so little about it.
No, here's the thing is, this is what's interesting is I can actually talk about this film without telling you anything about it.
Oh, good. Okay.
Well, I just want to set the stage because I might actually need some help. I think I need you to see it so that we can talk about it because I need to just – it's a film that I just can't – you don't walk – like, all right, Ford versus Ferrari – I can walk out and say, oh, entertaining. I like it. I can tell you why I liked it.
You can wrap it up in a nice little package and put it on your shelf and know what it was.
The Irishman isn't like a film that you normally get in the theaters, maybe ever, but certainly not anymore. And so I have to say my initial reaction of the film is that I respected the hell out of it, but I didn't love it as I'd kind of hoped I was going to love it.
Oh, interesting.
And it's just, I mean, it's a 3.5-hour movie, but it's more of a meditation on things rather than a big, like, you know, even like Godfather is like a sweeping saga.
Right. An epic, yeah.
The plot moves. There's certain things that happen. This film is kind of episodic and it's a strange movie and it's very intimate. It's not shot widescreen. It's shot 1.85 and you feel like, you know, I don't want to say this because it's the whole debate about Martin Scorsese and cinema.
Right.
I'm very fortunate that my theater for some reason played it. I'm just shocked. So I was like, I gotta go just by the fact that my theater of all places decided they're going to show The Irishman.
Right.
And I thought, well, you know, that's part of doing this show is that we can maybe talk about an experience that most people aren't going to get.
Yeah. And so, I'm not going to be able to see it in the theater.
No. And I was resigned to the fact that I'm going to see this thing on Netflix. And of course, you know, because of Netflix, you could pause if you want.
Yes.
And it's 3.5 hours. So people may be watching it in chunks. And of course, watching it in chunks, as I just mentioned with Booksmart, changes things. So I got to see it in one swoop where, you know, nobody's going to break my concentration and I can see it. But I have to say that I think it's fine to watch this film in your home.
Interesting. Okay. So it are you saying it has more in common with like a limited TV series?
Not, I mean, the structure is definitely, I mean, you know, I don't think Martin Scorsese knows how to make it that way. However, I think that if he was a different type of filmmaker and embraced what Netflix could offer and the money that they were shelling out, I think that he could have probably easily turned this into like an 8-part series, right?
Right.
That are like 50 minutes a pop. And so you'd have something in maybe 6 to 7 hours. I think that it's a saga that there's a lot of interesting details that you could have dived into maybe.
Interesting.
You know, but like, and then again, this is the stuff that I want to talk to you about. It has nothing to do with plot. It's about the de-aging technique.
Oh, okay.
I want to talk just because it isn't so much.
That's one of the things I know about the film and of course, Gemini Man.
Yeah. Here's the thing is that I think, again, someone like Scorsese, even though Hugo was a sort of a special effects marvel and things, I don't think that special effects are necessarily in his wheelhouse and that he doesn't know how to talk the language of that type of thing with maybe people who could pull it off. And so it's maybe the conception of what he thought that stuff could do or not do, because ultimately it's because of the flashback nature, it's a little confusing. And I never bought that these characters are supposed to be the age that they were during the flashbacks.
Oh, interesting. So the de-aging didn't actually even work, wasn't convincing.
You know, they didn't do the de-aging the way that they might have done, like in Marvel movies, you know, those non-cinema experiences.
Right.
But it's like they, you know, we have a lot of historical reference of what Al Pacino looked at a certain age.
Right.
What Robert De Niro. We know what Robert De Niro looks at like, say, 37,
right,
which I think is the age where a good chunk of the beginning of the movie takes place. And so when you're like, but he doesn't look like that. And it, the biggest problem is their bodies and their way that bodies move. You can't change that with digital effects. And so you don't buy that a younger person is on the screen. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I felt that way in Captain Marvel.
Yes, Captain Marvel. Right. But you know what? That actually had a weird, I think.
But that was also so brief that it wasn't really that big of an issue, right?
Well, so I'd like to know some of the making of, and maybe we'll get that, because, I mean, the movie was held up for a good year and a half while they worked on this.
Right.
And my guess is that the special effects teams at ILM first gave Scorsese that look. That may have looked more like what they looked like, but it had that weird sort of glossy digital sheen to it. And he's like, but that looks cartoony. So in order to make the characters look real, they don't quite look the age appropriate. But then what works well is when you see the scenes, and there are plenty of them, as they're older and maybe closer to the age they're at now or even older.
Right. Okay.
They look like, so when you see Robert De Niro at his like most old in the movie, obviously that's not how old he is in real life.
Right.
But that looks like he really is that old.
Okay.
And Pesci, when he's playing, because Pesci's character is older than De Niro's anyway. So his, and plus it works really well for Pesci because you haven't seen him on screen in years.
Right. Not years, years.
So I have really no idea. I don't see him showing up on Saturday Night Live doing a skit. So I have no idea what Pesci really looks like anymore. So when you see his character, you buy it. And then Pacino, the problem for me is that he doesn't really look like Hoffa looked like.
Oh, I see. Well, I can forgive that.
But so you put that. So again, my feelings are a little mixed, but I will say that what you're treated to, and I'm not telling you anything about it, it's just because it's not giving it away.
Right.
You're treated to like these performances from De Niro and Pacino and Pesci that are so beyond what you get in today's cinema. And that it's like a treat. Like you're like, wow, I actually am getting to see a film that feels like the Scorsese films, like just his style that he made when he makes these gangster movies.
Right.
You're seeing him back in a movie that you never thought you'd see him direct again. And you're seeing De Niro working with him that you never thought that was going to happen. Pesci and Pacino all together doing scenes. And that is exciting. And Harvey Keitel is in it. Not
a
lot.
Right. Yeah.
But you're getting like, it's like Keitel hasn't worked with him since Taxi Driver.
So is some of this just nostalgia then?
Well, it's not like, oh, it's a, but what I'm saying is the effect is you're like, as a watcher, a viewer, a spectator, you're a little bit in awe of the fact that, whoa, what am I watching here? I'm actually watching a movie that I never thought I was going to get. And I think that's what and it's not like even like, oh, it's almost over. No, you're getting a 3.5 hour film. It, to me, it went by like nothing, even though it wasn't an action movie.
If you're that engaged moment to moment with the performances, it is going to fly by.
And then it does something at a point in the movie that changes.
Okay, don't tell me anymore.
No, I'm just saying is that you actually have Scorsese changing gears as he sometimes does, and he makes the film about, you start to see that, oh, I now know what this movie is about. And it's a little bit profound and you start feeling things. So again, I'm very complicated in how I
feel.
Okay,
don't tell me anymore.
I know, but I'm telling, why I'm telling you is because I didn't really sell Roma to you and you refused to watch that.
Oh, I'm watching
this. So I need to make
this.
Sure that you have to watch this so we can talk about it, because I need your help to get your thoughts so we can talk about this film. I may need to see it a second time.
Yeah, well, you get to. That's the thing.
I know,
can watch it over and over.
So, but I just want to hear.
When does it come out on Netflix?
It's going to be out on Wednesday, the 27th.
Okay.
Or no, wait, the 28th. I don't know. Maybe it's tomorrow. Today's the 26th, right?
So, yes.
Oh, yeah, no. Yeah, today's the 26th. It's a Tuesday. Tomorrow, the 27th, is a Wednesday. So it's coming out tomorrow on Netflix.
Okay. Well, I may be watching it tomorrow night.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what you're going to think. I just know I want to talk to you about it because this is not a film. And maybe this is what we were trying to get at with our conversations in the last couple episodes, is that if something is really cinema, it's something that you just can't take in and say, oh, I saw this movie. It's something we need to discuss.
It's something that you need to digest.
Yeah.
And mull over and think about. And you can't just pull a Ford versus Ferrari on it, or a lot of these Hollywood movies. It's sort of I get what it is. I get, you know, it was entertaining. It was fun. It gave me a ride. It was enjoyable.
Yeah.
But it's not going to have you asking questions about your life or, you know.
Yeah, the best movies I've seen this year are movies that a few days later I couldn't stop thinking about them.
Absolutely. Yeah.
You know, Parasite, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, Joker, Midsommar, The Farewell, and now this film. You know, I don't know where it's all going to stack up. I just know that these are gifts that we're getting from filmmakers this year, and they're worth seeking out one way or the other.
Yeah, totally agree. And of course, we got to be working on our best films of the decade. Those lists are starting to come out.
Well, yeah. So here's the thing. I mean, we only got a few weeks left and I'm almost practically writing the episodes ourselves. Here's what I'd like to do. I'm going to put this out on out to the audience. Is that I would like to get an episode where we discuss the decade and what we think were the best films.
Yes.
And what we could do it is in like Siskel and Ebert style, where maybe we can pick a 10 list. And we don't get to talk about all of them, but then at the end, we actually go through each of our top tens with revealing our number one of the decade.
Well, but there's no big mystery on the number one.
There might be.
No. The best film of the decade is indisputable.
Maybe to you. I don't think we're going to have the same number one.
Really?
Yeah. I know what your number one is, but it's not going to be my number one.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah. Maybe, but I think I know where you're going, Fury Road. But hey, but then there's also other things that maybe we should talk about, like maybe like our favorite performances of the decade.
Right. Okay. Well,
like
the next five episodes can be all about the decade.
Yeah, I think it should be. And then, of course, you know, this year, I think that they're releasing these big movies earlier than ever, and some of them are on Netflix. So I actually feel like it'll be early in 2020 when we can reveal maybe our top picks of the year.
Top picks of the year, yeah.
Yeah, we didn't get to do that last year, but I did one on, you know, that we wrote up. But
yes.
I think we can do it this year.
I think so. I think we can.
We're going to find out.
Okay, so we didn't get to our topic
I know. Should we tell what we didn't get to?
Yeah, because it'll probably be the next episode or two, or, you know, within the next few episodes, we probably will talk about Paul Thomas Anderson.
Yes, we're going to, because you finally caught up, as we tried to talk before you got cut off, you caught up with Inherent Vice, but now you've also caught up with Phantom Thread.
Yes. And so I've now seen every Paul Thomas Anderson film. I've not seen all his music videos. He does a lot of those.
I saw that Tom York one. It was amazing.
Okay. I didn't see it. Yeah.
Well, that's on Netflix. It's like a 10-minute thing. You got to watch that.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. It's really cool. But yeah, it's like it's a different Paul Thomas Anderson. I don't count people's video and commercial work the same as I count their movie work.
Right. Yeah. No, it's just interesting that he does a lot of them.
Yeah. And I haven't, just as we start to think about our episode, I have not seen Magnolia in a long time.
Magnolia I've seen several times.
I've seen it a couple times, but I just haven't seen it in many years. I did this year rewatch Hard Eight.
Okay.
And I've seen Boogie Nights, you know, countless times. And Punch Drunk Love I haven't seen recently, but I've seen that a couple times.
Boogie Nights I only saw once when it came out.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
That's a film that I have seen. I've owned it on DVD and Blu-ray and have watched. And there's ones where I've seen the extra scenes out of that. And then, of course, There Will Be Blood. That's a movie where, even though I love it, it's not a movie you can watch over and over again, in my opinion.
Yeah, that's a good point.
It's just weird. It's like, it doesn't mean the movie isn't great or a masterpiece. It just doesn't necessarily lend itself to like repeated viewing.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we're going to get into this more.
That's something we can talk to, right?
Yeah. We're going to get into this more in a future episode because
That and a Joel Petroikis episode.
Okay.
We're not making fun of you, Joel. We're making fun of Teal for not getting on the stick and inviting you onto the show.
Oh, man. Yeah, I think Paul Thomas Anderson is one of our great filmmakers at the moment.
Yeah, well, that's the thing is now he is like, well, that's what Tarantino always talks about. He's created a resume.
Yes.
And you're looking at this body of work, and whether or not it's one's your favorite or another, you're just like, wow, he's given us something that we have to consider.
Exactly. And he's taken it to a new level recently.
Well, it sounds like can you tease me? It sounds like you were a fan of Phantom Thread.
I am a fan of Phantom Thread. Yeah.
I loved it.
Yeah.
That movie, it's just, here's why I loved it, is because we just says that this guy, it's not about, oh, this is a Paul Thomas Anderson movie. It's more like, if you walk into a Paul Thomas Anderson movie, you're not sure what you're going to get, because
He keeps trying new things. And this, Phantom Thread, I thought was fantastic.
Well, he also shot that movie himself.
I know.
And it looks fantastic.
Yeah.
Now we'll get into, because I want to talk about how I got to see that in 70mm and what the impact of that was, and why did he shoot it in 35, but why did he want it projected in 70mm? And that I think is a fascinating, because it gives it an aesthetic. And so we'll talk about that maybe it'll be next time. Who knows?
It had to be shot 35. Well, I guess he could have done it digitally, but.
No. Because he purposely wanted a certain grain quality.
Right.
He needed that photochemical look. And then the reason for the 70mm, we're just jumping into it, was, just this part. The reason why he wanted it presented in 70mm is because of the way film stocks are now. He wanted, for anybody who was going to the theater,
yeah.
He wanted a certain quality, a graininess, the way it would look. But that the quality of the 35mm prints, just, you know, it's not something that's bread and butter.
Right.
So it doesn't have the look that he wanted, even though the look of shooting it, but projected in 70 gave the actual visual look that he imagined in his head. So he figured that, well, it's not important for you to have to see it in 70, but for those who love that, he wanted to almost give them like, well, you're going to get to see it the way I wanted it to look on screen. And it was amazing. I think if you went and saw it in 70mm and said, well, why did I just pay money to see a film that looks, it doesn't look like, it's not big vistas, it's not shot like, you know, and it's a little bit grainy.
It almost all takes place in the one house.
The way it's shot, you almost can like reach out and touch the air.
Yes.
Inside the rooms.
Yes.
And then the threads, like it's all about costumes, right?
Right.
And you in the 70mm see every fiber.
Yeah.
Of the costumes he's working on. And so it's a textual thing.
Right. Yes. Okay. Okay. We got to wrap this up. We're coming back to this because we could spend another.
I'm getting excited. I know you're like, oh, I want to talk about it now.
We could spend another hour and a half on it easy.
And that's us. And that's about the show. You know, I know that you might not be able to spend another half hour and a half. You, the audience, you, the listener, might be like, what? I thought it was over. I'm driving and I just drove a few states on a Thanksgiving trip and it's still going on. I'm asking for the return trip. But you know what? I'm going to try to get this all edited and out so that if you are going on a trip on Wednesday or Thursday, maybe you can hear this episode.
A good holiday listening.
That's what it's all about. Holiday listening from Jim and Teal and stuff we've seen. Hey, thanks everyone for a fun year, and we look forward to this next year.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye, people.